This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
I'm so happy to be here tonight, and it was so generous of IMSB to invite me to do this author's talk. And what I'm going to be mainly focusing on is four things. One, how the book came to be. What is mindfulness, and why is it helpful for something like infertility or any major life crisis? For that matter, life overall. And then I want to give you some little tidbits of practices from the book. And so we'll see how far that I can get into that. Okay, so how was this book born? It started from my own personal experience with infertility, which was at this point almost 30 years ago. And I can't believe it was that long ago. So my husband and I tried for about 6 years to have a child, and we lost about 5 pregnancies. We did an IVF that didn't work out, a donor IVF cycle. This is the egg of a donor. The first one was my sister. And then we were actually in the first kind of pool to be matched with a donor through the center that started egg donation. We tried that several times. And at that point, there were a couple of options left. There was adoption and surrogacy. So surrogacy is having someone carry your child for you. It's an intentional birth. And in those days, it was through artificial insemination, or IUI. Nowadays, you don't really find traditional surrogacy because egg donation is so effective. So we almost had a child from adoption that fell through kind of at the last minute. And then we were absolutely blessed with the birth of our daughter through surrogacy, who is now 23 years old. She's in here somewhere. I won't point to her. So those 6 years were really, I'd have to say, horrible. They were the hardest times in my life. Various things happened. Not so much before, but certainly, well, yes, yeah, some before and since. Nothing has come close to what is called the life crisis of infertility. And it's a life crisis because it impacts every area of your life, your relationship with your partner, your family and friends. Other people are getting pregnant. You get invited to baby showers. Especially if you've just had a miscarriage or IVF didn't work out. It's, how do you say no to a friend and at the same time kind of take care of yourself? And it's overwhelming. There's no way to kind of stay in the present because you can just go into the past where there's all sorts of guilt or regret, or the future, which is fear or anxiety. And so the present is squeezed real thin. And so everything that sort of is happening is infertility. And everything else is sort of at the side. Very different from when we were doing the meditation. To really intentionally put a certain thing at the forefront and let everything else fall to the side. But when you have a life crisis, it's really hard to not have that be front and center stage. And the other reason why it's considered a crisis, along with it impacting all the areas of your life, is because how you cope doesn't really work. And the typical coping mechanism is control. And basically, it's just trying hard to succeed. And so effort equals success. And I personally remember in elementary school, we used to have report cards, and then in the back there were comments, you know, by the teachers. And this is a while ago. But it was always Janet, which was my original name. Janet always tries her best. And so I always got those stars for effort. And it really paid off for me. But then when you have a situation where it doesn't matter if you do every single thing right, that you have no control over the outcome. Infertility, like other life crises, and I mean, crisis could be something like cancer, but a crisis can be something like losing your job, you know, or finding that you don't have money to pay the rent. I mean, there's really kind of crises that happen all the time. That that if you, you know, when it really comes down to it, we don't really have control. There's this sort of myth that we have way more control than we actually have. And so, especially around some areas of life where, you know, you do everything right and it's just, it's not going to make a difference at all, that it becomes a crisis for that reason as well, because you just don't have the tools to be able to cope with it. And the other thing that happens is that we identify with our experience. And so there's this way of, you know, kind of womanhood is equated with motherhood. And if you're struggling to have a child, it doesn't really feel like you're totally a woman. For men, masculinity is equated with virility. And even if it's female factor, it doesn't quite feel like you're totally a man. And so you end up identifying with the experience. It's no longer a medical condition, but it's a definition of yourself. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was just to give you a little sample of the book, read to you this one piece that's called The Paradox of Infertility. And it's how infertility has a way of, even though we're trying so hard to give birth, it has a way of taking away life from ourselves. So here it is. Let's see. Though infertility is a medical condition, it often becomes much more, a challenge to your identity at its core. As an infertile person, you internalize Webster's definition, not fertile or productive, barren, synonym, sterile. Here lies the central paradox. How is it that in this very quest to bring new life into the world, you bring so little life of your own? Believing this definition of infertility is really scary, so you do what your instincts tell you to do, hide or run. The possibility that the fertility doctor might give an unwanted diagnosis can be so terrifying that you may perpetually delay the appointment or perhaps never go. Conversely, when you pursue treatment, you may not be able to stop, setting an addictive course that leads to increasingly lower probabilities of success. You race against time to find the one good egg, feeling you're not just running to become pregnant, but literally running for your life. Paradoxically, those very qualities you need most are least accessible. You assume, judge, mistrust, strive, and become impatient. You're fixated on how you should be and are trapped between grasping and pushing away. You engage in self-blame and criticism. Ultimately, you believe you have only yourself to blame. It's easy to give in to Webster's definition and see yourself as broken. It then becomes a natural compulsion to fix yourself, believing that only when you've reached your goal can you feel whole. So I've been specializing in this field for 20 years now, and my own experience was really no different from everyone else's. It seems to have the same impact. And the degrees of depression and anxiety for the infertile population is equal to people with the diagnosis of cancer, HIV, and heart disease. That's actually 4 studies. And so, you know, this is a really big issue that most people don't really understand as being as kind of traumatic as it actually is. And so what I did was everything that I could do to basically save myself. And so what that involved was counseling, individual counseling, couples counseling, family counseling. That was family when my sister became our egg donor. Went on vision quests, tried to use the wilderness to kind of be able to shore myself up, became a vision quest guide. I went into acupuncture, and somehow or another, the acupuncturist had this idea of doing acupuncture exorcism, which was pretty interesting. I went to a Buddhist Zendo a few times. I went to a Christian church. And then I ended up on this east-west path. And that eventually got me to India, where I went on a spiritual pilgrimage. And it was being in India that was pretty amazing, because in the United States, we're very organized. So, you know, materially, we really have it together. But spiritually, it's not that, not so much. But in India, it's the exact opposite. Everything is like incredibly chaotic, but it's just like alive with spirituality. And it was really during that time that I really knew that if I just stayed open to possibilities, that, you know, if I let go of how I should have a child, how they're kind of the way to kind of manifest this child, you know, according to the expectations, the assumptions of how you have a child. If you just open up to, you know, this the world of possibility, that I really did believe a child was going to come to me. And it was a matter of going from the outside in to the inside out. And what I mean by that was that it was tuning into what was going on inside me, and trusting that if I cultivated these qualities of patience and non-striving and non-judgment and compassion, that a child would follow. So actually what happened was when I got back to the States, my husband was there, and he had a pillow underneath his shirt. And and so what I found out at that point was that our surrogate was actually pregnant. And what was really pretty wild about it was that our second day in India, we went to a temple, and it was during this auspicious time of the year. And so it was a celebration of, I don't remember, some god or goddess. And our group was on a stage of this was this makeshift temple that was being built for this auspicious time, this celebration. And we were in the back room, and all of a sudden, this Indian man comes running in and says something in Indian. Nobody knows what he's saying. And then eventually someone realized it was fire. And so we were drinking tea, and we all got up, we dropped our teacups, and it ran out. And actually, I was one of two people who didn't get burned by the heat of the fire, because when it's really strong, it makes up a wind. And I'd have to say that it was the vision quest that got me to leave. You know, what happened, again, this is India in the non kind of way that the material world is sort of kind of in place. So there was this one little skinny ramp to get out of the room, and, you know, hundreds of people were trying to get down the ramp and finally out, but this wind was just so intense. And so as soon as I got on the ramp, I jumped off, went into this field that was, and then went into this kind of shoe stall, kind of threw some stuff down, climbed out the window, and found myself, you know, kind of far off. And curiously enough, when I got home and my husband met me at the airport, I found out that actually almost at that precise time, at least within 12 hours, that was when our child was created. And so one of the things that they say in India is that if you're in a fire and you actually don't really, you know, get hurt, that it burns off a lot of karma. So I tend to think that our daughter sort of saw this light and flew down. Anyway, so then a number of years later, I discovered mindfulness. And I realized that mindfulness was the perfect antidote to work with the issues that come with infertility and, again, any kind of life crisis. And so what is mindfulness? So I want to just use the definition from James Barres, because I think this one really applies to the talk tonight. Mindfulness is simply being aware of what is happening right now without wishing it were different. Enjoying the pleasant without holding on when it changes, which it will. And being with the unpleasant without fearing it will always be this way, which it won't. And so mindfulness is about being in the present. It's really like total acceptance. It's kind of a radical acceptance. It's getting out of this way that we tend to have a lens of judgment that goes between us and experience. And so this judgmental lens is constantly into this categorization. You know, I like this, I don't like this. This is good, this is bad. I like me, I don't like me. You know, this is success, this is failure. And so it's this way of judging what's happening, and it really creates a huge problem. I mean, it takes us out of the present moment, and it reduces a way that we can really connect with not only what's happening as it's happening, but also who we are. And the way to mindfulness, the entry to mindfulness, is through the vehicle of meditation. And what we learn in meditation, and this is what I was doing tonight in trying to kind of have you explore different ways of meditating, is that it's not about trying to get rid of or change or judge what's happening, whether that be with the breath or the body. It's how to open up and be with it. It's having a way of bringing mindful awareness, meaning just be with what's happening without wishing it was different. And this meditation is the practice ground for life. And so when also I was saying in the meditation that what happens is you bring your bare attention. So your bare attention is you're following the breath, and you're really getting to know the breath, and you're approaching it with curiosity. But you're also seeing how you're relating to the breath. So are you relating with any kind of resistance? You know, are you trying too hard? Are you slackening off? Or is your mind going off in 10,000 directions? And so you don't try to change the experience, but you try to change how you're relating to it. And that's what makes all the difference. And so, again, when you're dealing with life overall, but particularly something that's really hard, the magic of mindfulness is that, like, especially when you have a situation where you have no control over the outcome, you get out of trying to attain your goal and get into seeing how you're relating to what's happening. And so, you know, as a psychologist, I've had a lot of training in like a psychodynamic approach, which is looking a lot at the whys, you know, like where does this come from? And while that's important, mindfulness is really about how you work with what's happening, how you're relating to it. And so you're constantly putting your attention into where you're getting tripped up and where you're opening up. where you're resisting and where you're able to be with what's happening. And so mindfulness, just a little encapsulation, mindfulness is at the heart of Buddhist psychology, and Buddhist psychology is basically how we get stuck and how we open up. There's two main types of meditation. There's concentration meditation, which is like a mantra, and then there's insight meditation and mindfulness within insight meditation. And insight meditation is also called Vipassana. And so Insight Meditation Center, IMSB, is the kind of meditation that's practiced here, insight meditation. And it's called insight meditation because we look at how we get tripped up, where we get stuck, and how the mind gets confused by how we kind of see reality. And according to the Buddha, there's three truths of reality. And the problem is that we fight against these truths. So the first one is that life comes with inevitable suffering. Well, we have this kind of mindset that every time suffering occurs, so suffering could come in big or large forms. Suffering can come in, we just got to the light right before it turned red, you know. But it could also be suffering in big ways. That we tend to feel like this shouldn't be happening. You know, it's almost like there's, this being on this planet should be a kind of a Shangri-La. And so when suffering, or it's also called dissatisfaction, occurs, we fight against it. You know, we get into this thing of clinging to what we want and pushing away what we don't want. And so it's resistance that's the problem. And so the antidote then is acceptance. And that is acceptance in mindfulness terms means really just being with what's happening. And to be with it, then it's looking at how you're relating to it. It's not getting all of these emotions and these ways that, you know, we're identifying with the experience. And so if we bring that neutral attention to it, we can work with it. And then the second truth is everything changes. So this is the truth of impermanence, that really the only thing that's permanent is impermanence. And again, we have a way of thinking that, you know, all of our ducks should be in a row here. And when things kind of fall apart, then it's like, oh my gosh. So mindfulness is noticing, again, where the resistance is around this particular truth, that everything changes, and that's just the natural course. And then the third truth is that we tend to think that there is this sort of self, you know, we call it like ego. And according to the Buddha, there's really ever-fluctuating flow of experience. So the ego is how we kind of assume we should be, or assume or expect ourselves to be seen. Another way of looking at it is sort of superimposing ourself on experience. And so something happens, and it's happened to me, mine, and I. And this whole thing is actually a fabrication. According to this way of being, that there is no really defined self. It's just this ever-fluctuating flow of experience. And so it's this ego that has a way of, you know, making these different assumptions about who we are or who we should be. And it keeps us in a kind of a defensive place so that we fight against sort of, you know, sort of, are we okay in relationship to others? And so when you can let down those definitions, you are able to open up to what's called your original goodness or your Buddha nature. And what that means is that actually you're already whole and complete as you are with all your imperfections and inadequacies. So when every time you can see resistance coming in the form of, you know, fighting against sort of dissatisfaction, just the suffering, fighting against the way of kind of needing things to kind of stay in place, and fighting against a way of kind of superimposing yourself on what's happening, taking things personally, then mindfulness just allows you to notice the resistance and then, you know, bring on a neutral lens, and then you're able to work with whatever it is that's happening in a much more easy way. And so the reason why mindfulness is helpful for infertility and also other major life challenges is because we can shift out of this way of using control, of trying harder to succeed, which only makes things harder, and into awareness mode of looking how you're relating at the situation. You can, rather than getting lost in the past and the future, you can reside in the present moment. Rather than identifying with experience and kind of losing yourself in the process, you can take on a neutral perspective and kind of work with what's happening. And rather than going from like the outside and trying to kind of get everything lined up to be okay, mindfulness is really an inside-out approach. And then lastly, mindfulness is very paradoxical. And so it really turns our thinking around. So for example, one of the phrases that they say is, only when you accept yourself are you free to change. The harder you try, the more stuck you become. Another phrase is, when you, in the process of finding yourself, you lose yourself and then you gain the world. So that, in other words, as you are able to bring this neutral attention, you discover really who you are and, you know, how are you closing down? How are you opening up? And then you let go of that ego, that very kind of defined, kind of constrictive place. And as that happens, you start losing yourself and then you gain the world. You see that really you, along with everyone else, suffers. We're all in this together, and you can reside in this place of wholeness, you know, even with all the inadequacies and imperfections. And I really like this one. So when you look at zero, you see nothing, but when you look through it, you see the world. So the book evolved out of this 8-week program that I put together after I learned about mindfulness, and I've been doing that program for about 8 years now. So the book is really, it's very insight meditation related, in that it starts off with mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of thoughts and emotions. So how to work with thoughts and emotions, how to use the breath and the body to anchor our attention and get grounded. So in one of the first chapters, it goes into mindfulness of the breath. And so mindfulness of the breath is about using the breath to get anchored. And so when we were meditating, it's, you know, the breath is always here with us, and it's always accessible. And if you look at the meditations that have been like all over the world through the centuries, they all go with the breath. So one of the first things that I always teach is how to turn on the relaxation response. Because if you're having something that's really hard to deal with, but also life is so stressful nowadays anyway, that it's really important to turn on our relaxation response. Because the way that the stress response turns on is actually with the breath, and it's with the short, shallow breathing. And the way that the relaxation response turns on is with that deep abdominal breath. And so I pass out these felt hearts. And mindfulness, I should add, has both formal and informal practices. So the formal ones are like meditation, yoga, could be walking meditation, and then the informal practices. And that's how to just bring mindfulness into the day. And so I pass these out as the acronym. The felt is the acronym for feel every loving touch. And that's feel every loving touch of the breath. And so as you're feeling this piece of felt, you're remembering to just tune into the breath. Just get into those deep abdominal breaths to turn on that relaxation response. One of the the phrases that I was telling myself before this talk, and this is by Fritz Perls. Fear is excitement without the breath. So I just kept on, remember to breathe, and breathe deeply. So that's the first practice that I wanted to share with you. The other thing about mindfulness of the breath is that the way that we anchor to the present is the breath. And so if you're not only to turn on the relaxation response, but the breath is that bridge that connects the mind to the body. And so if we bring our attention into the breath, we can turn off that chattering mind and just stay put. And sometimes if you feel the breath in your belly, it's Thich Nhat Hanh has this tree practice, and imagine yourself as a tree. And if you stay in your trunk, then that's where you're stable. But if you stay in your head, this is like the tops of the tree. And if it's windy with like all sorts of like emotional storms, you're just all over the place. But if you just stay grounded in your belly or in your trunk, then you can just settle. Okay, so that's the first practice. And in the table, you can, if you'd like to take one of the felt pieces so that you can remember to do the practice. So then there's meditation on the body. So mindfulness is considered an embodied practice because it's how the body responds to thoughts, emotions, and experiences. And the body is a reliable source, but that we can turn to. It's our thoughts that create these stories, and that, you know, we get into the storyline, and then, as you know, before we know it, we're down a rabbit hole. And so our body is another resource where we can just get grounded. And so I'm going to just teach you this pause practice. So mindfulness is very much about being able to choose how to respond, to get out of that automatic reactivity mode, but be able to pause so that we can use awareness to kind of tune in and see what's happening with our thoughts, our emotions, and use our body as a way to just get grounded. And so you can try this really quickly. So just kind of see how you're feeling right now. And just notice any kind of, if there's any kind of maybe negative thought or distracting thought or some sort of thought that's maybe kind of uncomfortable. So just notice what the thought is. Don't try to judge it or dissect it in any way. Just acknowledge what the thought is. And now go into your emotions. So emotions and thoughts are connected. And so what is it that you're feeling? Just acknowledge, you know, one emotion that you're feeling right now. Again, don't try to change it, do anything with it. Just acknowledge it. And next, go into your body. And so our body is the expression. It's the storehouse of our emotions. And so move into your body, and this is where to put your attention. And so just notice how the body is feeling. And if there's any places of tightness or tension, you might even kind of move your body in any certain way, especially like if it's your shoulders, kind of move your shoulders around and your neck. I don't know if you're feeling anything in your, any kind of bones that need to kind of move. But bring all of your attention into your body and work with your body. So how are you working with the experience? You're working with your body right now. And now notice how you're feeling in your body and open your eyes and bring that more kind of calm and grounded state with you. So I really like this practice. I learned it in MBSR, which is Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction. It's called the STOP practice. STOP is the acronym for stop. T, take a breath. Observe your thoughts, your emotions, and then your body. bring your attention into your body, and then proceed. And one of the things they recommend is like having certain places, kind of repetitive places to practice the stop practice. And that could be like at a stoplight. So every time you're at a stoplight, then, oh, this is a good time to practice the stop practice, or what I call the pause practice. Okay. So then there's mindfulness of thoughts. So thoughts, as I was saying, have this way of really becoming a problem because they create stories. And we end up identifying with these stories. So the way that Buddhist psychology looks at thoughts is that it's not about trying to get rid of thoughts or change them, but it's how to look at thoughts skillfully. And it's the problem is not so much the thoughts that we have, but how tightly we hold on to them. So in mindfulness, when you look at really what suffering is really all about, it's clinging. It's clinging to what we want, and it's trying to get rid of what we don't want. And so we tend to really cling tightly to certain thoughts, to certain storylines. And so I like to bring in these finger cuffs as a way of looking at how to work with thoughts. So thoughts are seen, you know, just like what I was saying in the meditation, as mental formations like clouds in the sky. And thoughts aren't to be identified with. So, you know, if you're having a certain thought, it's like you are not your thought. And that's, you know, a really important thing to remember. Okay, so, but it's our resistance that's the problem. And so this is an exercise where you put your fingers in the finger cuff and you notice that the harder you try to get out of the finger cuff, the more stuck you become. And so this is one of the other paradoxes of mindfulness. The harder you try, the more stuck you become. And it's actually by turning towards. So when I put my fingers towards one another and I have more room here and get my fingers out really easily. And so this is also, you know, about always turn towards that which you resist. It's very counterintuitive, but mindfulness is all about like putting yourself into, like opening up the closet door, and, you know, oh, there's the monster, and then befriending the monster. Okay, so that's thoughts. And then mindfulness of emotions. And so mindfulness of emotions is, again, emotions are similar to thoughts. It's not about getting rid of emotions, but it's being able to open up to emotions, to bring the quality of openness to emotions. And so I like to just use this little kind of experiment here with food coloring, which sometimes turns into a disaster. This is based off of one of Buddha's stories of salt in water. But because you can't taste salt in water, I'm making it visual. So we're going to just pretend here that this food coloring is emotion. And so I'm going to put 3 drops of a really, you know, big emotion. Let's call it anger. And so we have anger in this small container. And you might notice how dense that color is. All you can see is basically anger. There's no transparency here. It's so solid and thick, all that is apparent is total anger. But if you put an equal number of drops into a large container, so 1, 2, 3, and see what happens when you have emotion in your body and you give it a lot of room, that it's actually pretty interesting what happens. And in some ways, it's almost kind of beautiful. It takes on all sorts of different shapes. It kind of morphs. And if you, you know, approach it with mindfulness, meaning just be with it, that even when it's all through your body, it's translucent. And so you can, like, see through it. And this is, I think, synonymous with being able to see through the other side. And so knowing what your options are. For some reason, this is totally dripping. So I want to end and just have a few minutes for questions, if you have any, with the last paradox. And so I have this piece on the paradox of infertility. And then the next piece is the paradox of mindfulness. And so I also want to say that I learned last week in the beginner's meditation that I was leading, John had this wonderful quote that I thought worked beautifully in this talk. So the quote is, "At the center of adversity is the seed of a greater good." So John has this memorized from like 30 years or more, I think. And I'm still working on memorizing it because it's a beautiful quote, and it really is all about how to turn crisis into opportunity, to turn obstacles into challenge. And this is really so much of the gift of mindfulness. I feel very blessed that I finally found it and that I have this Sangha to share mindfulness with. And the teachings are so profound and so accessible. And so here's the last paradox. Infertility, but I would also say really anything, is a catastrophe in every sense of the word. Yet it is the very struggle of infertility and its diminishing of reserves in every domain of life that can ultimately replenish and further you. It requires you to look for happiness not on the outside, but on the inside. The continual contractions through withdrawal, resentment, fear, and panic make you thirst for expansion, trust, acceptance, peace, and finally liberation. Everyone seeks happiness, and at this very moment when happiness seems lost, the human spirit will fight hardest to find where it lives. The final paradox is that infertility, or really any kind of crisis, is inevitably a birthing process. The labor is difficult and frightening, and we resist, but the process carried through brings forth a new spirit in all who are open to it. Okay, so just 5 minutes for any questions that you might have. So the title of the book is A Fertile Path, Guiding the Journey with Mindfulness and Compassion. So the first part is mindfulness, and then it goes into the compassion practices. And so compassion is a way of being able to hold the experience. Mindfulness is a way of being able to see clearly so that we don't get in our own way with all the ways that we confuse the mind with our emotions and with our storylines. And so compassion practices allow us to invite in and really feel that original goodness that I was talking about. And so there's various compassion practices. Sharon did a wonderful talk last week on loving kindness, and that's bringing these intentions of kindness towards ourselves and also towards others. Actually, the last practice that I have in the book is Tonglen. It's another compassion practice. We learned this in compassion cultivation training. It's Tibetan. It's actually it's a Tibetan practice, but it's very similar to what you were talking about. And it's a paradoxical practice because you breathe in suffering. And you breathe in the suffering of, I mean, you could do it a lot of different ways, but you could breathe in other people's suffering and then breathe out relief. And then you breathe in like the suffering that you can also relate to. And you breathe out like compassion and relief for yourself and others. And it's actually one of my favorite practices because it helps you really know that you're not alone, that we all suffer, and that we're all in this together. And it's that whole thing of breaking down the boundaries between ourselves and others and gets us into that place of our original goodness or our Buddha nature. So could always perhaps try that. Okay, well, apparently that clock is 2 minutes slow. I think it's 9:02. So thank you everyone so much for being here.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.